listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
With his administration apparently ready to go to war in Venezuela, make peace in Korea, and fight with Congress over funding for the wall with Mexico, President Trump spoke with the media on Monday after a meeting with the nation's governors, and we bring you that talk in its entirety here.
Thank you very much. Please, thank you very much. As governors, we all sort of get together and we have a good time, but we're going to accomplish a lot. It's going to be a very good meeting. Tremendous things are happening for our country. I'm now... Right after this meeting, I leave for Vietnam, where I meet with Chairman Kim, and we talk about something that, frankly, he never spoke to anybody about. But we're speaking, and we're speaking loud, and I think we can have a very good summit. I think we'll have a very tremendous summit. We want denuclearization, and I think you'll have a country that will set a lot of records for speed in terms of an economy. And I told you last night, it was a lovely dinner, but I told you how well we did with our trade talks in China, and it looks like they'll be coming back quickly again, and we're going to have another summit. We're going to have a signing summit, which is even better, so hopefully we can get that completed, but we're getting very, very close. Ambassador Lighthizer, Steve Mnuchin, a lot of folks in the room have been helping, and that's been great, and I just see our great secretary sitting there on drug prices, first time in 54 years that drug prices have actually gone down this year. So, Mr. Secretary, thank you very much. That's a great job. Yeah. Today it is my honor to welcome our nation's governors back to the White House after a wonderful evening last night, and I'm deeply grateful for your presence, your partnership, and your friendship. Many of you are such good friends. As we work together on behalf of all Americans, we're here to forge bonds of cooperation between our federal, state, and local governments as we strive to deliver a safe, bright, and prosperous future for every community in our magnificent nation. Thank you as well to all of my cabinet secretaries who are here today to share their energy, expertise, and devotion. They are devoted, they work so hard, and they're doing a terrific job. There are few, I say there are none, but there are few administrations that have accomplished what we've accomplished over the last 2 years and the first 2 years. It's been pretty incredible with tax cuts and regulation cuts, more regulations than any other administration in history, and that's very important. And we still have regulation, but you don't have 10 of identical regulations that you have to get approved and wiped out from different departments. So we've really cut it down. A highway that would take 17 or 18 years of approval now takes probably two, and we're trying to get it down to one. And it may be rejected on various grounds, including environmental. But we have it down to two, and we think we can get it down further. So it'll be something. You know, you have many highways and many roadways, and they're tied up for many years, and that won't be happening too much anymore. In my State of the Union address, I outlined many bipartisan priorities that we all share: delivering fair trade, rebuilding our nation's infrastructure, which we are going to work very hard on, because as governors, that has to be music to your ears. And I would like, on infrastructure, I would like you to call your senators and call your congressmen and women and get it done, because I'm ready. I want to sign. I am totally ready. Reducing the price of health care and prescription drugs, and we've made a lot of progress. As I said, first year in 54 years that prescription prices have gone down, which is a big statement, but we can get them a lot lower. We're in the process, Mr. Secretary, of doing that. Creating a safe and lawful immigration system, and keeping America safe. We're gathered today at a truly incredible time for our nation. Things are happening like rarely ever before. Since the election, we've created more than 5.3 million new jobs, including 500,000 brand new manufacturing jobs, and that number is going to go over 600,000 manufacturing jobs in just a very short period of time. And if you remember, manufacturing jobs were never coming back to our country. Well, they are coming back, and they're coming back very strongly. And we have companies opening up in the United States that we thought we lost, that would never be back. And some are coming back, and some are brand new, and they're big. And they're coming in, they're moving in, which is one of the reasons we need people to come in. They have to come in through a legal process. But with a 3.7 unemployment, we need to have people coming in. We need workers, frankly, because we have all of these companies pouring in. We were just discussing our great new governor of Michigan last night, where you have some good news coming up very soon. And we have car companies opening up in Michigan and Ohio and Pennsylvania and so many other places. I was with Prime Minister Abe of Japan, and he was saying could be seven different plants in a very short period of time, not to mention all of the plants that have already opened. So we need people. We have to have people, and they have to come in, but they have to come in legally and through merit. Nearly 5 million Americans have been lifted off of food stamps during this very short period of time. Blue-collar jobs are growing at their fastest pace in many decades. The unemployment rates for African Americans, and you've heard this many times, Hispanic Americans and Asian Americans have all reached their lowest levels ever recorded. And with women, it's now 64 years, lowest in 64 years. Soon it'll be historic. So America now has really the hottest economy on earth. Whenever I greet a prime minister or a president or any leaders of any countries, they always start off by saying, congratulations on your economy. It's been incredible. Congratulations. And many of them are trying to follow our formula, which was cutting taxes, cutting regulations, and many other things. We give incentives, and we work very hard at getting companies to come back in. Those companies that left, we in particular, we want to work. They left our country. They fired all of their workers. They moved to another country. They're now coming back. It's a great thing. In a few moments, our first session on vocational training and workforce development will begin. We want every citizen to gain the cutting-edge skills they need to enjoy a rewarding lifelong career. Many of the governors here today have identified this as a very top priority. My daughter Ivanka, who's going to be speaking later, is she has been so much involved, so incredibly involved. Where's Ivanka? Ivanka, keep going. My daughter's created millions of jobs. I don't know if anyone knows that, but she's created millions of jobs. So because of our roaring economy, there are more opportunities than ever before to get sidelined workers. And these are people that lost jobs and have never gotten them back. But now they're coming back and very, very rapidly get these sidelined workers back into the labor force. Last year, my administration created the Council for American Worker and launched the Pledge of America's Workers, where we've gained commitments from private sector leaders to hire and train more than 6.5 million Americans. Think of it, 6.5 million. And these are jobs that, for the most part, would not have happened. I was also proud to sign a modernized Perkins Vocational and Technical Education Act into law. We believe two simple rules: buy American and hire American. It used to be a terrible thing when you said America first. People said all sorts of things. It's terrible. It's a horrible. It's America first. It's make America great again. It's whatever you want to call it, but that's the way it is. I mean, you know very well, and some can't say, and some can say proudly, but we would focus so much on other countries. It was almost like we put those, not almost, we put those countries ahead of ours. We actually took those countries, put them ahead of ours. We can't do it. And we're going to help other countries, and we have great relationships, but we can't do that anymore. It's America first. Today, we also will discuss the bold action we took to address economic inequality by establishing opportunity zones as part of our historic tax cuts. It's incredible what's going on. I don't know. I think some of you really see it, okay? You see what's going on with the opportunity zones, far greater than anybody thought. And we've done a lot of them, and they have great incentives. And money is being put in by very rich people and rich companies in areas that you would have said nobody will ever invest in. We established incentives for investment in more than 8,700 distressed areas that you have designated in each of your states. You're designating some tough places. I say, can they give us some tougher places than that? They are tough. And it's incredibly, for the first time ever, it's really working. The concept was always good, but it wasn't done properly. I want to thank you for partnering with us in this critical effort to lift up neglected and totally forgotten communities. I also want to thank every governor here today who is supporting our new U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, the USMCA. I've long said that NAFTA is the worst trade deal that any country has ever signed. It emptied us out. We had a surplus with Mexico and Canada, and we went to $130 billion trade deficit with the combination of Mexico and Canada. And this deal will bring it back. We're opening it up to farmers. We're opening Canada as an example and Mexico to farmers. They were closed. It was a closed shop. They had all sorts of non-monetary trade barriers, and they had monetary trade barriers. They were charging for certain agricultural products an almost 300% tariff. Nobody ever talked about it. Nobody ever knew about it. And I'd go up to Wisconsin, and the farmers would say, sir, we can't compete. They're charging us 287%, to be exact. I said, you got to be kidding. And we did something about it. So the USMCA is very important. It'll help our dairy farmers in Wisconsin, our winemakers in Oregon and Washington and California, our automakers in Michigan and Ohio and Pennsylvania and all over, and dozens of other states and ranchers and farmers and growers and manufacturers from coast to coast. It's a very, very comprehensive deal. It's a deal that nobody thought we'd be able to get approved. I was able to get it approved, to be honest with you, by using tariffs. I was putting very substantial tariffs, or was getting ready to, on Canada, who was very tough to negotiate. You know, we think of, oh, Canada. Well, oh, Canada's tough. They're tough. And I said, look, you know, you're either going to do this or we're going to put 20-25% tariffs on your cars that you ship in here by the millions. And every time we had a problem, we just said, that's okay, don't worry about it, we'll put the tariffs on. And they said, okay, fine, that's okay, we'll sign. It was a really tough negotiation. And Same thing with Mexico. But in the end, we got it done. And it's a great deal for us. And it's a very good deal, I think, for Canada and for Mexico. They have to get it approved also. We have to get it approved. Let's see what happens. And I think it probably will be. It should. I think from our standpoint, I know how much they hate me. But they have to hate me even more not to get this deal approved. Okay, that's the only thing I can say. To be a prosperous nation, we must also be a safe nation. We passed groundbreaking criminal justice reform, and I have to thank so many people for that. But this was where super conservatives got together with super liberals, believe it or not. I mean, I'm looking at names on both sides and right down the middle, criminal justice reform, where people are put into a jail for a pretty minor act. There's nothing minor, but a pretty minor act, and they're put in jail for 45 years and 50 years, and there's no chance of ever coming out. And it was a very, and it's very tough, by the way. A lot of conservatives signed it, and signed it very willingly. In fact, they pushed it. They were pushing it, I think, as hard as the other side. But it's very, very important. Many states here today are following the same roadmap to help former inmates become productive and law-abiding citizens. And one of the things that's helping the inmates so much, you know this probably better than I do, the economy is so strong that inmates for the first time are getting jobs when they come out. And I have a friend who's hired 7 or 8. I can't say everyone was perfect, but he said 5 are, I'll always have them. They're great. They got a chance. Nobody would hire them because they have that whatever it is in the background. And it's a very tough situation for them in the past. But the economy is so strong. The economy, the strength of the economy, became our best friend. They couldn't get workers, and now they're hiring people that they normally wouldn't have. And the results are incredible. Companies all over the country are saying, wow, they're really doing a great job, and it makes me very happy. I think without that very powerful economy, it couldn't happen. So finally, to protect our communities, we must secure the border against human trafficking, drug smuggling, and crime of all types. The human trafficking is a tremendous problem where mostly women, and they're tied up and they're taped up and they're put in the back of cars, and the car does not come through the port of entry. I mean, you watch this, everything comes through. 90% of the drugs don't come through the port of entry. 90% of the drugs and the big stuff goes out to the desert, makes a left, and goes where you don't have any wall. I'm going to call it a wall. You know, they'd like me to call it a barrier. It's a wall. It's a big, beautiful, powerful steel wall that you can see through, which is very important to be able to see through. And if you don't have it, you're not going to have borders. You're not going to have a country pretty soon, because we're spending a fortune. We're doing an incredible job. The Border Patrol has been amazing. The military has been amazing. I called in the military, and they've been amazing. But if we had a wall, we'd save a fortune, not only on drugs that are being smuggled into the country, and you're talking about billions and billions and billions of dollars worth of drugs, but we'd save it just on not having to pay military, not having to pay so much in the Border Patrol. The Border Patrol can go to other locations and other places. But I'll say this, Border Patrol and ICE, and I'm proud of ICE because they go into areas where a lot of people don't want to go, including law enforcement. These are tough, tough people that they're dealing with, and you need tough people. The ICE people, they're tough, but they're incredible. I mean, they're just incredible in so many ways. They are patriotic people. They love our country. They want it to work, and they'll go into situations that you want no part of. When you look at these MS-13 gangs, sheriffs all over the country have told me we're very happy to have ICE come in and take over, because this is a group of people that hard to even understand how they could have developed this way. They're mean, they're sadistic, the crimes are incredible. We're taking them out by the thousands, and we're bringing them back to where they came from. And in some cases, we're putting them in jail, but, you know, then we pay for them for the next 40 years. But we're bringing them back where they came from. And I told Guatemala, and I told Honduras, and I told El Salvador, three places where they send us tremendous numbers of people. And they're rough people. They're not sending us their finest. It doesn't make sense. Why would they send their finest? They're sending us some very, as I would sometimes say, rough hombres. These are rough, rough, tough people, many criminal people. And I told these three countries, you know, we send them $500 million a year. I said, we're not sending it anymore. And you organize caravans, And these caravans that are coming up, we had one, and we've broken them up. I don't know if you've been seeing. We've broken them up. We've gotten them broken up in many cases now before they get here. But you take a look at Tijuana, Mexico. Thousands and thousands of people are sitting there trying to get into our country. And if we didn't have a wall there that we've totally renovated and fixed, if we didn't have that wall, it would be impossible even for the military to stop them. Because don't forget, unlike other countries, and this is a good thing, I don't want to create controversy, because I hate controversy, believe me. But unlike other countries, we don't let people get shot. You know, we don't have people standing there with the most sophisticated machine guns in the world and use them. Many countries do. Many countries do. We can't do that. We can't do that. This country can't do that. But the barrier does it very simply. It just doesn't let them in. So you take a look at a place like Tijuana and other places, it's incredible what that wall has done. And that's not even the upper, you know, the most, the best of our walls. We have a great system now. We have a prototype. We have, I expect to have 250 to 300 miles of wall built in the very near future. Secretary Nielsen is here right now, and we will shortly have about 200 miles under construction. We just started a 47-mile patch. We have different patches. We bid it out tough. We have a much better prototype. It's actually a beautiful wall. It's a beautiful looking, actually, I've always said part of the wall was that previous administrations, when they did little walls, they built them so badly, so unattractive. So I wouldn't want them in my backyard. And the new one is incredible looking. It's a piece of art in a sense. It's still, and it's, by the way, more effective. It's more effective. So we are doing a job. We're getting it up. We have beautiful prototypes. We're working with the Army Corps of Engineers, who are total pros. And I don't know if you saw what I put on Twitter, but I put on Twitter a piece of it. That's not the new prototype. The new prototype has started in different locations. But we're going to be pretty soon having well over a couple of hundred miles of wall up. We don't have to go 2,000. We never planned on going 2,000. It's 2,000 from the Gulf to the Pacific. It's 2,000 miles. But you have many natural boundaries, including really tough waters, which you don't need the wall. We have very, very rugged mountain areas, which you don't need the wall. Actually, if we do a really good job and if we have some money left over, we might even throw them in areas where you would say you don't need them because they'll figure a way. That will be the area. That will become the weak spot. It's like water. It just seeks its own. But these people, they have the traffickers. They're vicious. They're smart. The coyotes. How about the name coyote? They have people tied up, put in the back of trucks and vans. They can't go through checkpoints. They have to go through open areas. Can't walk through. You can't go through it because even if they don't do much of an inspection of your truck or your car, they do open the back door or they do look through a window. You can't have women sitting there that are tied up. So when I hear the other side say, and we have some of the other side here, but when I hear the other side say, oh no, everything goes through the checkpoint, that's absolutely false. You have areas where you literally have roads that are carved in the sand that it's used so much. They go right through these roads. They go right. They hang a left and hang another left and welcome to the United States. There's nobody there to even talk to. Because you're talking about 2,000 miles. You're talking about a lot of area. So we're doing really well on the wall. The emergency, you've all been reading, we do have an emergency. We have an emergency of people pouring into our country that we don't want. Criminals, smugglers, we have drugs pouring into our country. We can't have it. We can't have it. We cannot allow this to happen to our country. Most of the major drugs are coming through the southern border. This will make it, you're never going to stop it completely, but we can stop it a lot. One of the things that Ambassador Lighthizer and Steve and all of the people that are working with China, the fentanyl is a tremendous problem. It seems to be made 100% in China, 100%. Now, China's paying us right now billions and billions of dollars of tariffs a month. Every month, billions of dollars. I love it, personally. I love it. But they're paying billions of dollars, and it's hurting them. It's not good for them. And I said to President Xi, I said, President, you have to do me a favor. As part of our trade deal, it has nothing to do with trade, or certainly very little, but we're having shipped over here from China fentanyl. It's killing 88,000 people a year, and probably more. That's just the ones we know about. It's deadly. A little tiny spoonful can wipe out a state. It's hard to believe. Can wipe out an entire state, a spoonful of this stuff. And in China, they have a very, very tough penalty for drugs. It's called the death penalty. And I said to President Xi, you don't have much of a drug problem. Do you have a drug problem? No. No drug problem. I said, so you have 1.4 billion people, and you don't have a drug problem. That's right, no drug problem. I said, what do you attribute that to? Death penalty, quick trial. They don't have trials that last 19 years. At the end of the judge dies, everybody dies. The only one living is the one that did the damage. You know, they have what's called a quick trial. It goes quick. It doesn't take a lot of time. And if you're a drug dealer, you say, you know what, maybe I'll just sort of stay out of China. Singapore, the same thing. So I said to President Xi, I said, you know, if you would criminalize the sale of fentanyl into the United States, you would be saving many, many lives. It took me 1 minute, and he agreed. Because it's not criminalized. I think they view it as an industrial drug or something. It's not criminalized. And as part of our deal, and Bob, don't forget to put that down, but as part of our deal, I think we're going to get a criminalization of fentanyl being sold into the United States. It'll stop. It'll stop. Very important. And I have to tell you, I have to really thank President Xi both for that, and he has been a big help with respect to North Korea. I have a very, very good relationship with Kim Jong-un, very, very good. But we need all the help we can get. And as you know, about 92% of the goods going into North Korea go through China. And President Xi's been very good. He's been very, very good. Now, you know, it helps that we are in a strong trading position. But nevertheless, he's been very strong, and he's, for the most part, held it. At the beginning, he was perfect. I told him the other day, at the beginning, you were perfect. Now you're good. Not quite as good. You got to get better. But maybe we'll make a deal, and then we won't have to worry about that any longer. So that'll be something really great. But he's been great, and the fentanyl is, they're already working on that process. And, you know, I said, do you need any other approvals? No. I said, well, that works a lot different than this country. He needs no other approval. When I got the basketball players out, the three basketball players, that was a beautiful scene. I was in China, and you have these three, you know, potential stars, and I guess they're going into the NBA draft or just have. But I said, would you do me a favor? Three players were just arrested. They were arrested for stealing in Louis Vuitton sunglasses. And I wasn't happy with those three players because they never gave our country much credit for having gotten them out. And believe me, they'd be in jail. Stealing in a store in China is a very big offense. And I said, would you do me a favor? I was having dinner with him at this incredible show that he put on in a ballroom the likes of which few people have ever seen. It was an incredible evening. Melania is here, and I'm talking. And it just happened. And they were arrested. They were put in jail. And I said, Mr. President, could you do me a favor? Could you let the three basketball players out? He didn't know about it. He called over his people. He's got 10 people standing behind him. Everyone is central casting. Central casting. Glasses, pad. Boom. He was over it. He came back. He reported within 2 minutes, explained basketball players, bomb, bomb. And I said, it would be a great thing if you could possibly let them out. He goes, so be it. They're out. I said, is this different than our country? Huh? Is this a little bit different? And we got them out. Then we came back, and the one father said, well, we don't know that Trump helped. I sent a consultant. That consultant would have gotten nowhere. But, you know, we just have a great relationship with so many of these countries. And I think in some cases it's tough. There are many countries that take advantage of us very seriously, both at NATO and on trade. The European Union's very, very tough. Very, very tough. They don't allow our products in. They don't allow our farming goods in. You people know, many of you represent farm states. They won't, you know that better than anybody. They won't allow our farm products, and they don't take any. They have these monetary barriers that are brutal. They're worse than than others. The cars, they charge us big tariffs, and it's very hard for a car to get in, number one, but if it does, they have to pay a big tariff, whereas we charge them almost nothing when they send their cars to us, Mercedes and BMW and all of the things that they send. So we're taking care of it. I mean, we've informed them that, look, if you're not going to play ball, President Obama in 8 years couldn't do a thing. They wouldn't even meet with him. They said, we have no intention of meeting. They wouldn't even meet with President Obama. They wouldn't meet with President Bush. EU is one of the toughest, maybe in certain ways tougher than China, just smaller from our standpoint. But they have to meet. And we told them, have to meet, sorry. And if you don't meet, we're going to tariff the hell out of you. And they're going to meet. I mean, they're going to meet. But we lost last year with the European Union $151 billion. This has been going on for many years. Think of it, $151 billion. We take their product, they don't take ours. We don't charge them tariffs, they charge us tariffs. Other than that, it's a very fair arrangement. And so, by the way, we pay for their military because we pay almost, getting close to 100% for their military. I've gotten them to put up over $100 billion toward NATO, which has made a big impact. But so they have to treat us fairly. We want to have a great relationship. I have a great relationship with the leaders, but we have to be treated fairly. So overall, we're doing a great job for our country. Our country has rarely done better, maybe never done better from an economy standpoint. We're very proud of it. And we have tremendous potential when we fix these trade deals, because we're being ripped by everybody. We are just being ripped. We lose $800 billion a year on trade. Think of it. It's inconceivable. $800 billion. Nobody even knows what that means. And we're fixing that all up. We start with Mexico, Canada, China. China's the big one. China's 50% of the number, even more. And we're doing very well. That could happen fairly soon, or it might not happen at all, okay? Might not happen at all, but I think it's going to happen, and it could happen fairly soon. The relationship is great. So I just want to thank all of the governors for being here. You're very special people. I think we have 17 brand new governors, right? Brand new ones, very smart ones, like my friend, huh? Congratulations, it's a great, you're going to have, you have such an easy state. That's so easy. Great state of Illinois. What an easy state. I don't know, huh? Have you found it to be easier or tougher than you thought?
Well, you're going to help us out.
I'll help you out. I'll help everybody out. I'm going to help you out. Congratulations. It's an honor to have you all at the White House. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello, welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. Inter-Palestinian tensions are moving Middle Eastern peace even further away. Will Israel and Palestine be locked in conflict forever? Well, I ask Mohammad Ishtaye, President Mahmoud Abbas's advisor.
With yet another American leader trying to find a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the parties remain bogged down by mutual stalling accusations as hopes for peace continue to fade. Where might a breakthrough come from to move the process along? Is there a chance of compromise with both sides entrenched in politics and grudges? How can the international actors help resolve this century-long quarrel?
Mohammad Ishtaye, advisor to President Mahmoud Abbas, welcome to the show. It's really great to have you with us today. So, Mr. Ishtaye, the United States hosted a Middle East conference in Warsaw, and the Palestinian side was invited to take part in discussion of the Arab-Israeli tensions. Palestine's foreign ministry called the summit an American conspiracy aimed at getting the participants to adopt Washington's views on Palestinian issue. So did Palestine, by boycotting it, effectively throw in the towel without fighting? I mean, were you that sure that your voice wouldn't be heard?
Well, look, this sort of coalition that Washington was trying to create in Warsaw, it actually produced zero results. It has no value whatsoever. They wanted to focus attention and shift attention from it being Israel, the source of conflict in the region, to shift attention that Iran is the source of tension in the region, which is totally untrue. The most serious problems that the whole Middle East is facing is actually the Israeli threats to all region. Israel has occupied Sinai, the Golan Heights, Palestinian territory, South Lebanon, and so on. So without ending the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, you're not going to go anywhere with solving the Middle East issue. This is one. Secondly, we know that it was a show. Germany did not attend, France didn't attend, Russia did not attend, the Palestinians were in Moscow. So all in all, what United States was trying to do is simply a show. And therefore, we are not really not okay. We are not interested in photo opportunities. We are interested in serious issues.
So United States Vice President Mike Pence has said that the Warsaw Summit marked the beginning of the new era with Benjamin Netanyahu breaking bread with the Arab leaders. Do you feel sort of betrayed by your Arab friends here?
Well, look, the governing factor between us and the Arab countries is the Arab Peace Initiative. The Arab Peace Initiative is the guiding lines for the Arab-Israeli relations, which explicitly states that Israel should withdraw from occupied territories in return of Arab normalizing relations with Israel. This has not happened, and therefore, I think the Arabs should not betray, not us, should not betray the Arab Peace Initiative. The Saudis were solid about it. Kuwait was solid about it. Many Arab countries who didn't attend, and those who attended, they said explicitly that this is not going to be at the expense of Palestine. This is handling other issues. For us, very simple. We said that we are not going to go. We were hoping that Arab countries should not attend, but each of the Arab countries was actually basing its calculation on its personal interest within a regional context. But by all means, this is not the way to handle Middle East issues. The way to handle it is that the Arab Peace Initiative is the guiding lines for everybody.
The Palestinian leadership has no trust in the United States as fair mediators in the Middle East peace process anymore. Trump now is promising to roll out the Middle Eastern deal of the century in April. What are your expectations of this deal?
First of all, there will be no deal because a deal needs a partner. The Palestinians are not partners to what President Trump is initiating, one. Secondly, this deal is going to be born dead because we know the content of the deal that only talks about a state in Gaza that doesn't refer to 67 borders, that doesn't refer to Jerusalem as occupied territory, that doesn't deal with the Palestinian refugees, that moves the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, the American embassy, that is using a blackmail technique and methodology to try to push the Palestinians to surrender and to accept the peace initiative or the Trump ideas, that is not going to happen. So for us, we have spoken loud and clear. Our voice was loud and clear. Our president has explicitly stated that we are not going to be party to this deal. And until now, United States has not found any partner, not in Europe and not in the Arab countries.
Okay, I see your point. But there are speculations in the press that the deal may include Washington's recognition of East Jerusalem as Palestine's capital. If that happens, will you trust the United States with a mediator role again?
Well, look, for us, it is very explicit that we need an international conference that is based on international law. The main issue for us is to respect international law, to respect United Nations resolutions. That is one. Secondly, our president has called for an international conference. Thirdly, United States has always proven to be a biased broker. And fourth important issue, that what is needed from United States is to build confidence with the Palestinians before United States is submitting its ideas. Confidence building measures, it means that they have to reconsider Jerusalem as a capital of Israel. They have to go back on this issue. They have to open the Washington PLO office and to resume funding for UNRWA as well as other international organizations. So the Palestinians are waiting for confidence-building measures from Washington.
So United States has criticized Palestine many times for stalling the peace talks. Palestine's chief negotiator, Saeb Erekat, says there have been 40 meetings with the U.S. representatives in 2017 alone. Why do the Americans have an impression that Palestinians are not interested in peace? Are Palestinians actually stalling at all those meetings?
Well, I mean, this is very unfair accusations. We have been in this peace process since October 30th, 1991, since Madrid conference. The peace process that we have engaged in, it was up and down, and all the time we were engaged. We had meetings, 3 meetings with President Obama, 47 meetings with John Kerry. We were engaging with President Clinton. We were engaging with President Bush, the son and the father, and so on and so forth. On the contrary, Palestinians, they did never shun away their faces from any serious negotiations. And now they are accusing us of staying away from the negotiating table at a time when they are dictating the shots. United States is taking unilateral measures against things that has been agreed between us and the Israelis. Let me give you an example. Jerusalem is a negotiation issue between us and Israel with the signature of the Israelis. The Israelis accepted that Jerusalem is a negotiation issue. The Israelis have accepted that refugees is a negotiation issue. The Israelis have accepted that 67 border is on the table. So the Israelis, us and the Israelis, they have accepted all of these things. And now President Trump is saying that Jerusalem is off the table, the refugees is off the table, no reference to 67 borders, settlements are there to stay. They are taking positions even far ahead than the very right-wing government in Israel. So therefore, it is not we who are staying away from the table. It is United States that wants the Palestinians to surrender and that wants the Palestinians to only sign the deal, okay, which will not happen.
Okay, so your president, President Abbas, called for establishing a multilateral mechanism for reconciliation, this time not led by the United States. However, it didn't look like Europe was too excited about a concerted effort in mediation. Why do you think? I mean, can Palestine hope to get more traction for this idea?
Yes, simply yes. Because in Annapolis conference 2003, it was agreed that international conference should take place in Moscow. It didn't happen. The French tried to have an international conference. The United States attended. John Kerry was there, but Netanyahu didn't come. The Israelis didn't come. Now, for us, the most important side of the story is that the international conference that President Abbas has spoken about is there on the table. There are some European countries who are saying, let's wait for a Trump initiative. The moment it is dead, then we will make the other move. And I think there are certain European countries that are really preparing some ideas to call it the post-Trump failure ideas that might emerge from Europe. And here I call upon the Russian Federation to really take the lead on this issue with China, with some European countries, because we have to have a fallback position the moment a Trump initiative is declared dead.
So Palestine has long insisted on a two-state solution, but in September 2018, President Abbas reportedly brought up the idea of a tripartite confederation with Palestine, Israel, Jordan. Is this a sign of things to come, of the direction that the debate is about to take? Is it time to look for outside-the-box solutions?
Well, look, Israel is systematically destroying the possibility of a Palestinian state, which means systematically destroying a two-state solution, which does enjoy an international consensus. One. Secondly, it is the state of Israel that is pushing things into a total deterioration. What does it mean? The Palestinians and Israelis and Palestinian Muslims and Christians, they are now about 6.6 million Palestinians. And there are about 6.5 million Jews in historical Palestine. Next year, 2020, the Palestinians will be 51.6% of the total population of Palestine. So either today, Israel will accept the idea of two-state solution with a Palestinian state on the borders of 67 with Jerusalem as its capital, or we are going to be slipping, I underline slipping, into a one-state reality. I underline reality, which means that we will be living in a de facto one-state situation. Therefore, Israel will find itself neither Jewish, as they claim, nor democratic, as they claim. And therefore, what does this mean? It means that Israel will become, by de facto, an apartheid state, and by de jure an apartheid state.
Okay, we have to take a short break right now, Mr. Ishtaye. Sorry, I have to interrupt you. We're back. We'll continue talking to Mohamed Ishtaye, President Mahmoud Abbas's advisor, discussing the Middle East peace process and the roadblocks it's facing. Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back with Mohamed Ishtaye, President Mahmoud Abbas's advisor, discussing the Arab-Israeli tensions. Welcome back to the show. Mr. Ishtaye, Benjamin Netanyahu is a hardline leader whose base is to the right of center among the conservative, more militant Israelis. Do you think the ideology that his appeal rests on will let him actually give something up to Palestinians? I mean, will his voters and ministers and army general friends allow him to do it?
No, the issue is not whether they will allow him or not. The issue himself is not ready to give anything. And he is not giving. This is our right. This is our territory that is occupied. Netanyahu has been given the chance. In 2010, he had meetings with our president at the State Department in the presence of Secretary Hillary Clinton. Then he had meetings with our president in Sharm el-Sheikh in the presence of Hosni Mubarak. And then he had a third meeting with our president at his house in West Jerusalem. So all in all, he had all the opportunity to really proceed and make progress with peace. He never did. And I think Netanyahu is an ideologist, and he's a reflection of a right-wing society that is breeding a very right-wing government. And there is no partner in Israel for us with the presence of Mr. Netanyahu.
So do you think Palestinians should just wait for a change of leadership before any peace hopes can be realized?
Not necessarily, because we don't have to wait for somebody who's going to be a de Klerk in South Africa. I think the international community should put pressure on Israel to move. We should not wait for an occupier to end its occupation. There has to be a serious international pressure in order for Netanyahu to submit to the international will that this occupation should end and it cannot continue. And mechanisms to do pressure is economic, political, and there are so many means in which the international community has put apartheid system in South Africa on its knees, and it was ended with international pressure. Netanyahu should face the same thing.
Talks between Fatah, Hamas, and other Palestinian factions brought no tangible results in bringing all sides to consensus. Can any agreement be reached with Israel while there is no unity in the Palestinian ranks?
Well, the issue is not really related to unity, because the split among Palestinians has been there since 2007. So what about a situation in which there was no split between 1993 and 2007? There was no split and there was no progress. And so therefore, I don't think that, of course, the split does harm the Palestinian cause, and people will come and claim, look, you know, Palestinians are divided. With whom are we going to talk? But the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, is the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, whether in Gaza, in the West Bank, in diaspora, everywhere. And Abu Mazen, our president, he talks on behalf of the PLO with Israel, and all the agreements has been signed with the PLO. So if the Israelis are ready for peace, we are ready. The problem is that they find justification and excuses for really not ending the occupation that has occurred on our territory in 1967.
Mahmoud Abbas has been tightening screws on Gaza, cutting salaries to former government workers in the strip and slashing funds for electricity supply from Israel to Gaza. Netanyahu has even accused Abbas of choking Gaza. I mean, I understand that his measures are aimed at pressuring Hamas to disarm, but I mean, people's support for the group is as strong as ever. Does this mean Mahmoud Abbas's measures are ineffective?
Well, look, it's very unfair to say that the Palestinian Authority is actually putting all these sort of things. The real fact is that it is Israel who is putting Gaza under siege. It is Israel that has been, since 2007 until today, that has been really closing off Gaza fully and totally. There is no movement of people. If Israel is going to allow Palestinians out of the Gaza Strip, even to come to the West Bank, we welcome that. If Israel is going to allow trade between West Bank and Gaza, we want that. the Palestinians in Gaza are our people. There are certain measures that have been taken, and now these measures are reversed. Salaries has gone from 50% to 75%, and now it's going to be a totally different story. So we should not really shift focus from who is putting Gaza under siege. It is the Israeli measures that has been there since 2007, and all Gaza is sieged. The Palestinian Authority is not really circling Gaza or putting Gaza under siege, because at the end of the day, we know the conflict with Hamas is political. We will not put measures that is going to cause harm to our people. These are our people. Collective punishment is not something that we do. We, of course, we want reconciliation to happen because the split is not in our favor. And we try, the only way for us to end this split is by dialogue and by agreement. Unfortunately, many agreements that has been signed, it has not been yielding simply because of regional factors and regional players who don't want to see this Palestinian unity happening, including Israel.
So senior Hamas leader Mahmoud al-Zahar has accused people linked to Fatah of trying to drag Gaza into another war with Israel by firing rockets from the Strip. How can you respond to these accusations?
Look, I mean, Hamas is in full control of Gaza, and Fatah is not armed in Gaza. Hamas is responsible for the security situation in Gaza. This is something which is ridiculous, because when the Palestinian Authority was in Gaza, these people, they were firing, you know, rockets on Israel and saying that this is in the name of resistance. Why is it now that if somebody else is throwing rockets on Israel, it becomes trying to put Israel and Hamas and Gaza into conflict? This is really something that is not understandable, and it is not correct. The most important thing is not who is going to push Gaza. Gaza, the people in Gaza are our people. We want this conflict to end. We want the split to end. And therefore, there is only one way out of this misery of Gaza, which is the Palestinian unity, one authority, one man, one machine gun, one law. And that's the only way out. If not, then we go to elections. We have said, if our model for reconciliation is not acceptable to Hamas, and if Hamas's model for reconciliation is not acceptable to us, then let's go to the people. Let's refer the whole issue to the people. Let the Palestinian people decide through elections and decide who is going to run the affairs of the Palestinian people. We are ready for that. We are ready for elections, and we are ready to go tomorrow for elections the moment Israel allows us to have elections in Jerusalem and Hamas allows us to have elections in the Gaza Strip.
So won't those moves only make things worse? I mean, the logical question here is, how can Fatah hope to gain any foothold in Gaza if it's willing to treat its residents this way? I mean, according to December poll by the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research, if snap elections were to be held, Hamas leader would have left President Abbas way behind.
Well, look, I mean, opinion polls, we know what opinion polls are about. It does show that Fatah is in the lead. It does show that all the opinion polls that I consult and see and so on, I am on board of this organization that you are referring to. And at the end of the day, as I said, the issue is not about opinion polls. The issue is that if there is a will, there is a way. We want elections to take place. We are also asking European capitals to put pressure on Israel to allow us to have elections in Jerusalem. And I hope that the issue with Hamas will be settled and that Hamas will really come to ground and accept the idea of going to elections very soon.
So according to some reports flowing in after the U.S.-led conference in Warsaw, under Trump's so-called deal of the country of the century, the Gulf states would bear the brunt of the costs of Gaza's restoration. Would you welcome their involvement? I mean, would Hamas welcome them, given how close it wants to become with Iran now?
Well, look, I mean, any assistance for Gaza is welcome by us, as long as it goes through the legitimate leadership of the Palestinian people, the legitimate of the Palestinian Authority. As long as it goes through the official channels, we welcome that, because at the end of the day, as I said earlier, these people are our people. But if this assistance is going to be enclaved with political umbrella, with hidden agendas for certain countries, that's a totally different story. Then it becomes a manifestation of the split rather than really helping the reconciliation.
You know, a recent report by a Middle East Media Research Institute says the relations between the two Palestinian parties are now at the point, quote, where each side is saying that the other no longer represents the Palestinian people. That's a direct quote. How do Palestinians feel about this, in your opinion? I mean, do they feel represented by any of the parties at this table? Can the whole affair result in an intifada against Hamas?
Well, the testing field for this assumption is the opinion polls, is the ballot boxes. So instead of claiming this and that, I think that we challenge Hamas to accept the idea of elections. We are ready for it. We are ready to go to that. And we will bring democracy back into action for the Palestinian political arena, which is very important to us to really keep this sort of democratic, embryonic democracy that we started with. It should not die down. One. The second important issue is that these sort of claims, claim and counterclaim, it does harm Palestine. It doesn't really help Hamas. It doesn't help anybody to say that, you know, this government is legitimate, this government is not legitimate. At the end of the day, the international community will say, to hell with both of them. And we should avoid that. And I think we should be responsible and say that this split is harming our people. The way out is reconciliation, is not to discredit each other on this issue. But we know also that there is a legitimate leadership. President Abbas has been elected by the people. The PLO, which President Abbas is also the chairman, is the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, which is recognized by all Palestinians, which is recognized by all Arab countries, which is recognized by the international community and the United Nations. So if there is a split in the authority, there is a unity in the PLO.
All right, thank you very much for this interview. We were talking to Mohammed Ishtayeh, advisor to President Mahmoud Abbas, discussing tensions between Israel and Palestine and ways to defuse them. That is it for this edition of Sophie & Co. I'll see you next time.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.